This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. In a moment, we will be getting more on that result from France. First, a brief introduction to my panel this evening. With me, the former Conservative MP, hoping to be re-elected, Stephen Crabb. He was also Secretary of State for Work and Pensions in David Cameron's government. Welcome to you. The UKIP MEP, Patrick O'Flynn, is here as well. He's his party's economic spokesman. Hello.
Hello.
Someone who's been there, done that, as far as general elections are concerned, the former Labour MP, Angela Smith. She won Basildon in Tony Blair's landslide 20 years ago. Bet that feels a long time ago, doesn't it?
Feels a long time. It's my 10th general election looming now.
Oh, my goodness. Well, she is leader of the Labour peers in the House of Lords. And also here with us tonight, Sir Simon Fraser, who was the top civil servant at the Foreign Office during the coalition years. Before that, he worked in Brussels on trade issues alongside Lord Mandelson. And now, Sir Simon, with the business consultancy Flint Global and the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House. So welcome to you. Thanks for joining us. And on this day, of course, when we've had this result from France, I wonder, how do you think diplomats here in the Foreign Office will be greeting the news that it's Emmanuel Macron and not Marine Le Pen?
Well, first of all, I think people expected Emmanuel Macron to win. I think he has won big. I'll give you my own personal view, which is that it's a good result for France, a good result for Europe, and a good result for Britain as well. And I suspect that there will be, in most of the foreign ministries and governments around Europe, a sense of welcome for his election. He is a very talented individual. He's obviously
done
extremely. I have met him. He's a very charismatic, bright guy, and very able. Of course, he's got a lot of work to do ahead of him now. He's come from virtually nowhere to win this election. But I think that people will welcome his election and will think that this is a new beginning, an opportunity for France.
Do you think, I mean, he's 39. Can anyone at 39 really have what it takes to become a president of a country, particularly one who has never had elected office?
Well, he is young, it's true. He has, of course, served in ministerial roles, a ministerial role at least, under President Hollande. 39 is young, but actually, if you remember, I think Bill Clinton and even Tony Blair were not a lot older than that when they took office. So so let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
All right. Well, look, Hugh Schofield is joining us on the line now, our correspondent in Paris. And Hugh, a comprehensive victory then for Emmanuel Macron. But of course, getting the presidency isn't the end of it, is it? He's got to try to replicate his individual success in assembly elections coming up in June. Can he do that?
Well, that's the key question that he faces now. It is an extraordinary personal achievement, but you know, one of the question marks over him is this kind of solitariness of him, and he is such an extraordinary individual. One wonders whether he has the capacity to mobilise around him enough of a kind of classical political structure to keep it going and spread the success. I mean, he says he represents a new kind of politics, but one feels one's heard that before. So a certain sort of suspicion does have to creep into what is otherwise a thoroughly deserved and fantastic victory for him.
Then there is this question
of the parliamentary elections, which he will have to win with his movement or Marche if he wants to be able to govern simply with the majority behind him.
Because En Marche has no assembly members at the moment. Do you think socialists and Republicans will join up now behind him so that he can get that majority in the French Parliament?
Some will, but if they're to sign up for the En Marche movement, they have to leave their own parties behind. So we're going to see a big, big struggle here. And he sees there as being something called, you know, what he calls the logic of the institutions, which means that when a president is elected, invariably in the past, they've got a majority in the elections, of legislative elections that have followed. And that may happen. I mean, the other parties are saying, oh, absolutely not. He's a one-off and, his movement is full of novices. We'll regain the ground we've lost now in the parliament elections, and he'll be forced to make arrangements with us, particularly if this is the Republicans on the right who are saying this, because he can't possibly do it by himself. But I'm not so sure. I mean, when people talk about a dying political world here, I mean, they're not entirely wrong. I mean, he really has shown the old parties up for being the slightly decrepit bodies that they were.
How's the Le Pen camp greeting this news, and what does she do now?
Well, with sort of defiance and saying that it's you know that it's all a big success, and of course in a way it is. I mean, what she's done in the last years is extraordinary, and you know her father got through in 2002. She's doubled his vote since then. He's now at 35%, and so on. I mean, she can certainly legitimately claim to be a major force in the country. And the fact that there's only two MPs out of 577 is a travesty. But I think it also has to be said that it was not the brilliant performance that it could have been. It could have been much better, and she totally wrecked it in the last few days with her abysmal performance in the debate, where she just reminded everyone, I think, of why the party is at heart a party of protest. She said afterwards, I'm here to echo the anger of the people. And well, okay, she did that, but that's just not enough and to become a party of government.
And just remind us of the percentages. Are these the final results through now then, Hugh?
Well, I'm not sure what you're seeing, but I don't think we've had the definitive results, but the projected ones are normally very, very accurate, and it's sort of 65% to 35%. So he got that symbolic point of being able to say, I've got two-thirds of the vote behind me. But one thing that people are also saying is that there's a fairly big abstention, quite a big what they call vote blank here, people who turn up vote to be citizens but just cast an empty ballot. And that, if you add them to the abstentions, you've got a large chunk of the country that didn't turn out at all. And he certainly can't say that he has a majority behind his programme, because, of course, many people who voted for him were voting just to keep out Marine Le Pen.
Hugh, thank you. Well, as you were saying, that much of the Le Pen failure was down perhaps to that abysmal performance, Hugh described it. And Patrick O'Flynn, you were nodding there. I mean, you agree with that, do you?
I do. I think she came over as Mrs. Angry, didn't she? And while we might have expected Macron to win, the margin is bigger than anyone expected. And this idea that there's some inevitability of Mrs. Le Pen becoming president of France in 5 years' time, I think that's extremely questionable.
So you didn't agree with Nigel Farage, who said he thought that she was the real deal?
Well, I always make it my position is to never really try even to interfere in elections in other countries, because I didn't particularly like it when Barack Obama interfered in our referendum, although it probably ended up doing my side of the deal a bit of good. But I think tonight, Macron, fantastic achievement politically, to come from no party, sort of unknown as a front ranker a year ago, to where he is now. The only question I have is it's a vague platform, isn't it? Some people think he's an insurgent. Some people think he's an embodiment of the establishment.
Stephen and Angela, I mean, how do you view this? What do you think? Do you think it's a bit of a vague platform? There's a lot of idealism being thrown.
A lot of idealism. It smacks a lot of Blair in the mid-1990s. Doesn't it? But let's just come back to Le Pen for a moment, because I take Patrick's point about not wanting to be seen to interfere in other countries' elections. But actually, there's right and wrong here, isn't there? This is a black and white election. So much of our politics that we talk about is in shades of grey and imperfect choices. But actually, when you've got somebody leading the Front National against somebody who's standing up for liberal ideals, actually, there's a clear black and white right and wrong choice. So I think it is a good moment for France. Massive challenges ahead. I'm not fully convinced yet that Macron's got what it takes to be able to assemble a coalition of assembly members around him to deliver on what he wants to do, which is quite modest, but nevertheless, people have tried in France before to reform labour laws, to reduce public spending, and they've come a cropper. So he's got big, big challenges.
Did your wife's French? Did she vote?
Yes, she got up early, got the early train out of Wales today, got to the polling station in London, and she voted for Macron.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Angela?
It just seems to me that what he's offering is hope, idealism and optimism. And the whole Le Pen message was aggressive, unpleasant. And Stephen, I agree with Stephen, it's clear-cut right or wrong. But I think that message of optimism and hope. And I remember, I was looking, interestingly, back at some old campaign videos from 1997 from the Labour Party just over the weekend, which was the first election I was a candidate, first time I won. And they were very optimistic. And if you look at the whole structure of the campaign now, this is not an optimistic campaign. Wherever you stand during the general election, this does not seem optimistic. Brexit is not optimistic. The whole thing seems to me to be a complete change of mood. And Macron is probably the man of his time. I think it's one to say he's completely inexperienced. He does have a bit of experience in government, though not as an elected politician. Mm. And that's clearly what attracted people. I think there's a fundamental change happening in politics. This is not business as usual anymore.
We've seen the certainties have gone, which is why some people saying Le Pen could win.
Well, having sat through and watched Donald Trump get elected, to see us, those of us who believe in having a sort of a wider outlook in life, lose the Brexit vote, see a Conservative government get elected, you know, there was not much optimism. Seeing Macron win actually restores my faith in optimism.
Simon Fraser.
And it's interesting that Le Pen tried to present him again this evening as the candidate of continuity.
Yes.
But actually he's the candidate who's taken on and beaten all three of the main established parties in France, the Socialists, the Republicans and the Front National.
I'm sure.
So he is actually an insurgent. But I absolutely agree with what has been said about the scale of the challenge ahead of him now, both by Hugh and by Stephen.
One of the phrases that came out, the attacks with which Marine Le Pen was aiming at Emmanuel Macron, was saying that whoever wins, she said, a woman will be in charge, either her, Marine Le Pen, or Angela Merkel. Simon Fraser, do you think there is some truth in that?
Well, I think Angela Merkel is quite used to being in charge already, so that wouldn't be a huge change. Of course, one thing that Emmanuel Macron has said is that he's very keen to have a very balanced cabinet, and he's very keen, if possible, to appoint a woman as prime minister. One of the things he's got to do very soon after the transfer of presidential power, which will be next Sunday, will be to appoint his prime minister and a government, even before the parliamentary election in June. It may then be changed in the light of the result of that. So we'll see a bit more very soon about how he's going to construct his team.
This is a very important election for the UK as well, particularly with Brexit. How we respond to him, you wonder whether Theresa May should have held her fire and be offered a state visit to Emmanuel Macron rather than Donald Trump. It would be far more popular anyway. But the relationship that we have with Macron, our government has with Macron, will be absolutely crucial.
Simon Fraser, after the German elections later in the year, then obviously there is a bit of a pause. Whatever people say, the negotiations might be going on, but everybody's waiting to see what happens with the German elections. What then will be the focus of the EU leaders? Will they go absolutely hell for leather to focus on Brexit, do you think, or might other concerns fill their heads?
Emmanuel Macron is basically an orthodox French politician on European policy issues. He believes in the EU, he believes in the euro, he accepts that there's got to be reform of the governance of the eurozone in particular, and there's got to be economic reform. He also believes in the relationship with Germany. And I think that when we have the new German Chancellor elected in September, you will see a renewed effort by France and Germany to give new dynamism to the EU. Brexit will be part of that agenda, but it'll only be part of that agenda, and it won't actually be the top of their agenda, because their agenda will be their own agenda for the EU. So whether that's going to make the Brexit negotiations easier or more difficult is a very important question. We shouldn't assume that Emmanuel Macron being elected automatically makes things easier for Britain. Even though he understands us, he understands the city, he understands liberal economics, nevertheless,
he has talked about a hard Brexit, hasn't he?
He's got to fight for French interests.
Mm. Stephen?
I don't think the election of Macron makes it any bit easier for Britain, and we weren't expecting it to. You know, this is somebody who has shown his colours very early on to the Prime Minister and to other politicians in Europe that he believes in making this tough for the UK. Nevertheless, he does like Britain, he understands us. He's far more globalist than a lot of recent French politicians. And I think there's an opportunity there, and Theresa May and her ministerial team need to seize that and build that bridge as quickly as possible.
They do, but the problem has been that during the local election campaign to the general, Theresa May's comments on Brexit have been designed to win votes in the UK. So I'm a bloody difficult woman, as she says, will not help when she goes to negotiate in our interests on Brexit. So I think she's got to start looking and acting like a prime minister, and not just somebody trying to be prime minister and a parliamentary candidate, if she really wants to make the negotiations run as smoothly as possible and in the best interests of the UK.
Patrick O'Flynn, do you think, I mean, there was the moment which we will discuss, the breakdown of relations, the so-called dinner which broke down with Jean-Claude Juncker saying afterwards that he left sceptical and pessimistic about any deal being able to be struck, that Theresa May was living in another galaxy. She then answered back and said, I will be a bloody difficult woman in these talks. Do you think that by ramping up the rhetoric, maximising the anti-EU sentiment, she's basically successfully maximised her Leave vote support at these elections, and with that has embraced UKIP voters? They've now switched into the Conservative fold because they think they've got a strong leader with Theresa May.
To an extent, that's all correct. The moment I would pick out is actually the moment where, very fortuitously, the Conservative Prime Minister was able to stand in front of number 10 on the day before the local elections and make a sort of Boadicea moment. And that the timing of that was all splendid for the Conservative Party. But I'd just like to take issue with one thing, the idea that Brexit is doom and gloom. I think if the Labour Party sticks to this idea, they will completely miss...
That's not what I said, though, Patrick.
Well, you said
it?
It's a pessimistic time. Well,
I think it is. People are worried about it.
Well, I think for millions of former Labour voters, you are going to find out that they have shifted their view.
But you misunderstand what I'm saying, Patrick,
please
about
talk
this.
Over each other,
it's the uncertainty that worries people.
Angela, yes, you're saying the uncertainty. How helpful, Stephen, do you think it was to put dynamite, as it were, under the diplomacy, you know, with Theresa May accusing European politicians and officials of seeking to influence the result of the general election?
It wasn't dynamite. And, you know, we are in a general election campaign. I thought, actually, Juncker behaved very foolishly. I think if he wanted to make himself look ridiculous, and he has, through the leaking of what was a private Downing Street dinner. And... you know, the idea that this was done in a way to kind of maximise former UKIP voters, the truth is, and I've been going out on doorsteps week after week for months now, Labour and UKIP voters have been coming over to the Conservatives precisely because of Theresa May's leadership, not because of comments made in the wake of things that Juncker might have said in the wake of a dinner. It's because people understand that we are going into some very uncertain times, and who do you want governing your country, leading the government? Do you want Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn? And that is as simple as that. The election is all about that choice in the next few weeks.
So, Simon, how did you greet it? I mean, you know, in terms of diplomacy, it wasn't a great day, was it?
Well, I mean, I do agree with Stephen. You know, we are in a general election campaign, so the politics and the diplomacy is going to be bumpy. I thought it was a really bad leak. It was a very, you know, it's a leak which is designed actually to undermine trust in the negotiation. I accept that. Having said that, I think the Prime Minister did decide to exploit it for her own political ends, not least to help crush UKIP, which was part of her objective last week. But the idea that this country is terrified of being bullied by the head of cabinet or the chief of staff of the president of the European Commission, to my mind, stretches credulity somewhat. There are two points I want to make about the diplomacy on this. First of all, we've got to get through the election campaign, but it's really important that when we do, there is enough space for a sensible, constructive negotiation to take place on Europe. And it's very important that both sides don't, you know, squeeze that space out, that they keep the opportunity going. And secondly, I think this country needs to be more proactive in this negotiation. We seem to be allowing the EU side to call the tune. We haven't come forward with a plan for what this new relationship is going to be with the EU. We haven't come forward with a proposal on the rights of EU citizens in this country. And I hope that, again, when we get through the election campaign, the government will get onto the front foot.
Stephen.
Good advice. Very good advice.
But is that going to happen? Because we hear a lot of talk, don't we, about sorting priority issues, that there's agreement that the EU nationals issue has to be sorted.
Yeah.
But how? We don't know how.
I think most pragmatic, reasonable, sensible people can see that there is a deal waiting to be done. People on the European side and within Britain as well. The question will be...
But hasn't Theresa May said no deal is better than a bad deal? So
no, but
she's also made it
absolutely clear that her preference is to get that balanced deal, a free trade deal with the remainder of members of the European Union. There is no reason why that shouldn't happen if pragmatism wins the day. Now, there have been plenty of episodes in European history where pragmatism hasn't won the day. And as Simon says rightly, we need to make sure and protect and preserve a space to allow sensible negotiation to happen once all of this cycle of German, French, UK elections are out of the way.
So, Simon, Theresa May was saying on the steps of number 10, Britain's negotiating position in Europe has been misrepresented in the continental press. The European Commission's negotiating stance has hardened. Has it? I mean, has it changed really from the very start?
I don't actually think it has. In fact, in the negotiation, which of course hasn't really begun yet, my interpretation, both of the way that Britain triggered Article 50 and the way the EU side came back with its negotiating guidelines, was that it was quite pragmatic on both sides, actually, in setting out their positions, clearly different positions, but allowing enough sort of incentive for each side to engage in negotiation. And I don't think that the EU side has really significantly hardened its position since then, although there has been this discussion about the amount of money and so forth.
100 billion.
I also think that, you know, we sometimes say it's unreasonable for the EU side to expect to negotiate the separation before we talk about the future relationship. But actually, in my view, since we are the country that's asked to leave, I think it's not unreasonable for them to say, well, let's work out how you're going to leave, and then we'll work out what the future is. Clearly, in the end, those two things have got to come together, and we've done somewhat in parallel. So, again, I come back to my point. Let's try to avoid allowing the rhetoric to destroy the opportunity for negotiation, which I think everybody is still looking for.
Angela Smith?
I think part of the reason why the rhetoric has led this is the government didn't really have a plan. It was caught unawares by the vote, and they hadn't expected to be leave, which is why David Cameron, having said, win or lose, I'm going to stay as Prime Minister, and as soon as the result was announced, he was off. And the whole reason for the court case, other things, has been because the government hasn't had a plan. It's been very slow moving on. And the issue about EU nationals could have been resolved. We did Article 50, and that would have removed that as an issue, and the negotiations could have started in a different mood and a different tone. So I don't think it's been well handled, and I totally agree with Simon. Once we get past the general election, maybe things will settle down and the Prime Minister will start negotiations. But she has to recognise that the things she says to win votes in the UK may not be the best way to set the tone of the debate after the election is over if she remains Prime Minister.
Patrick, Michel Barnier, who's the chief negotiator, has made it clear that parallel talks won't happen at the start, that the exit bill has to be sorted, EU nationals have to be sorted, the question of the border between north and south of Ireland has to be sorted.
And Gibraltar.
And then possibly move on.
Sufficient progress has to be made.
OK, sufficient progress. So it's not going to be parallel talks. You won't get a trade deal straight up, will you?
Well, that depends if you take the view that this is a two-sided negotiation, or you take the view that the Brussels figures can hand down conditions as tablets of stone.
But they're the other side of the table negotiating.
He would say that, wouldn't he? That's an opening gambit. And if Theresa May is serious, and I hope she is, that she is prepared to walk away, then I think, you know, our extent of our financial contribution is going to loom large, and the UK being the biggest export market for the EU. And one more thing, I just disagree with Angela. I think Theresa May does have a plan, and I just think at this stage the plan is to wrap herself in red, white and blue, and afterwards I foresee some very, very big compromises that she doesn't want to talk about at the moment.
Simon, just to ask you then, Patrick's hopeful that maybe with a bit of eyeballing that the EU people will pull back and they won't be quite so threatening. Do you see it that way, or do you think that these are the negotiating lines that they've set out and agreed between the 27 countries and that's how it's going to be?
I think there's a clear framework for the structure of the negotiation. I think actually probably the two sides are not quite as far apart on that as some of the rhetoric is. I do think that we will be able to make some progress on the status of EU nationals and British nationals. I think we'll have to find a way of agreeing at least on the principles of the financial settlement. And if we can do that, then I think, after the German election, our hope must be that we can get into the more substantive negotiation about the future relationship, which I absolutely agree is vitally important for this country, for people here, for businesses here, you know, and for the future of our relations with our European friends.
Let me bring in now Helen Lewis, Deputy Editor of the New Statesman, and we can turn a little bit more to domestic policies. Standout moments for you this week, I guess, might feature around about Thursday into Friday.
Yeah,
possibly.
I think the temptation to read across from the local elections to the general elections to some extent should be resisted, but it certainly gives us a couple of really interesting indicators. The first, obviously, is the collapse in UKIP. They only held on to a handful of the seats they were contesting. The second is that the Lib Dem, hashtag Lib Dem fight back, has been slightly overhyped. You know, they actually really struggled in places like Cheltenham, where you'd have expected it was a very affluent place, it's a very Remain-heavy place. They really struggled to make gains there, which suggests that, you know, their vote share, however, has gone up. So that suggests problems at the general election, where they might pile up votes in places that they don't necessarily need them, which is exactly the same problem that Labour are having. I mean, a terrible night for them overall, with pockets of resilience like some of those Metro Mayor elections. But they might end up in exactly the same place, where actually they end up with a vote share that doesn't look, you know, bleedingly awful, but the number of seats they get is really awful. And I think the one that's the sort of story that I haven't heard anything about, we've talked a little bit about, you know, Tory gains in Scotland, but the other side of that coin is the resilience of the SNP is extraordinary, given that they are currently in government in Holyrood. They are utterly dominant in terms of Westminster seats held. You know, in that position, you would expect a government party to get a bit of a thrashing. And actually, they got, you know, they had a little bit of a nibble at the edges. So that's another really extraordinary moment, I think.
But in both elections, those conventions were broken, weren't they? Because, yes, the Conservatives Conservatives in government should have been the losers. Labour as the opposition should have been the winners. Angela, just tell me what you think of these reports that Labour people within the Jeremy Corbyn team are saying, look, we don't need to look so much at winning seats in the election, but we need to be driving up the vote share. And there are reports today that they are arguing that Jeremy Corbyn should keep his job if after the general election he matches the 30.4% that Ed Miliband won at the 2015 general election. Is that the way to look at it?
Well, of course it is, and I hope, you know, find that side of reporting incredible. I've read the stories. I don't know there's any truth in it whatsoever, but the duty of any party leader is to maximise their representation in Parliament and want to win as many seats as possible. Now, part of doing that is driving up the vote overall, because you don't win seats in isolation. You normally get a mood going through the country, how we did in 1997, which we won so many seats that we'd never been expected to win. So the priority has to be to win seats. And, you know, I've been out in Hove this weekend, which is one of our highly marginal seats. And actually, it seemed to me the support was hardening for our candidate, the MP, was MP, I suppose he's not at this moment, Peter Kyle. So, you know, I think we'll see some mixed results around the country. I think we'll see some of the more marginal seats that Labour hold stay in Labour.
But you're saying it's an uphill battle, though.
It is
after
difficult.
Those election results, those must have been very disappointing.
They were disappointing. And the one bit I would take issue from him is about some pockets of resilience. It wasn't just the metro mayors. You know, around the country, some very interesting results took place. I was looking at my former county of Essex, where Ivan Henderson, the former MP, got a thumping majority, pushed UKIP into third place and romped home with over 50% of the vote. So around the country, saw some interesting results. But no, those results don't give me any cheer. But I'm not sure how much you can always tell from local elections. We all try to extrapolate from local elections into a general election when the turnout is probably about a third or a quarter of what it will be in a general election. And it tends to be in local elections the least enthusiastic people are the ones who don't vote, the most enthusiastic ones do. So there's everything to play for us coming general election.
Stephen Crabb, this message about no complacency, and we sort of say, you're saying no complacency.
No, that's absolutely right.
However, you know, if you look at it, there is no guarantee with turnout being much lower in local elections. Yeah. You know, things can change when it comes to a general election.
And people have been getting carried away with opinion polls. We had that opinion poll in Wales that suggested that we were going to be the largest share of votes for the first time in 150 years or something. And people should just calm down a bit. Actually, winning seats back from the Labour Party, particularly in urban areas, is going to be difficult, which is why we need to be out there every single day. And when Theresa May talks about no complacency, it isn't just for effect. She actually means it. If we are going to increase her majority to enable her to do the stuff that we've been talking about with regards to Brexit, then we need to campaign harder.
Helen, obviously you're talking about read across, and you know, there's been this talk about a Tory landslide. Do you think it is possible to get a Tory landslide if you base it on the results that we had at the local election?
The projection is, I think, Labour on 27%. So for comparison, Ed Miliband got 30.4% and then the Tories up at 37. I mean, that would certainly suggest a very healthy... I don't think anyone would, you know, sniff at a majority of 60-70. So Theresa May would probably be, relatively happy with that. It is, we are in a kind of slightly mad situation where kind of anything less than a 100-plus majority is seen as being a bit kind of, not very, very good. But yeah, it's very, as Stephen says, there are difficulties with directly taking seats off Labour in a lot of places where there are big, it's not very far before we get to big majorities. That said, we've talked a lot about how polls are wrong. The polls were absolutely right in France in both rounds of that election. You know, so I think that we can be too sniffy about them. They certainly do suggest a thumping Conservative lead.
And are we saying goodbye to UKIP now, Patrick? I mean, you lost 147 council seats. You gained one. With your journalist's hat on,
right?
What would be your opening paragraph about the UKIP performance this week?
Well, I think my opening paragraph, say I'm back on the Daily Express
yes? Just imagine.
Would be that UKIP won its biggest victory and the biggest victory any party could have done
in
June 2016. Let me carry on. Yes, of course.
Right.
I mean, the forthcoming test is the general election. I mean, not being facetious against my own party, but one thing we know is we can't lose seats. We have no seats. This general election is not going to be about overall vote share for UKIP. It is going going to be about us making a sensible attempt in the areas we're strongest. It's also going to be about the duty of UKIP in the future. We can do many things. We can stand up a stronger approach to integration.
You're sticking with UKIP,
are you? Yeah, lower integration.
You're not tempted
lower
to
immigration.
Join the
no,
Tories.
Absolutely not.
And, you're staying with the darker forces within UKIP,
it's
as
not
Stephen
dark
Wolf,
forces.
Your former colleague, called
Well,
them.
Stephen's gone off in his own tangent, hasn't he? But if I make the point, we've got one thing we have to do in UKIP. There are lots of things we can do, generally. One thing we have to do, which we owe all the people in the last 20 years or more who've campaigned for this, is to be there, harrowing, putting pressure on to deliver a full Brexit in this country
all
over
right.
the next 2 years.
OK, difficult Stephen's... to do that without any members
well, no,
of Parliament.
We've done big things without MPs before.
But Stephen said something about Theresa May needs a big majority so she can get on with what she wants to do with Brexit. Now, what was it that Theresa May lost when she was putting Article 50 forward? Absolutely nothing. She got her bill through unamended. And what worries me about this talk about getting a big majority, we have a Prime Minister who doesn't like opposition. And if Brexit is going to be successful and not be a disaster, it will only be because there is challenge in the system. There is opposition and there's debate and discussion and not one person just being stubborn to get their own.
All of that is fine. What you say, but we have a parliament. We have a parliament that was elected pre-Brexit. It doesn't reflect the current state of our national politics.
Oh, that's nonsense.
And Theresa May is going to go into negotiate with brand new president of France, Angela Merkel, with a renewed mandate.
Clutching at straws here.
No,
Stephen.
No, absolutely not. Theresa May will get her mandate, and she's going to get it very substantially.
Simon Fraser, are there any perils in having a big majority? Do you think? Speaking as an official, you know, you've been permanent secretary in the business department, in the foreign office?
Well, I think it's, I mean, there can be perils in having a big majority because I actually agree that it's useful to have a debate. And because the Brexit is such an important issue that I really think it's important that we have a proper political debate and a societal debate about it in this country, accepting that we're going to do it and we're going to go ahead and do it. The other thing I'd say is, however big your majority, it's always useful to listen to your civil servants because they do have some knowledge and experience and they can help and they are there to help politicians. And it's good when politicians recognise that.
We understand. Noted and understood. Helen, just run us through a couple of the policy announcements that we've heard about today. The Labour tax announcement, for instance.
Yeah, so Labour want us to report this as saying, you know, they will only raise tax on the top 5% of people. Obviously, everyone's given into the temptation to put a figure on that, which is 80,000. So the idea is that there will be no extra taxes on earnings under 80,000. They will freeze the standard rate of VAT. At the same time, Theresa May's been talking about mental health today. She wants to scrap the Mental Health Act. She says that, you know, there are lots of unnecessary detentions because the thresholds for detaining people are too low. That impacts disproportionately on black and minority ethnic people. And she also wants every primary and secondary school to have staff trained in mental health first aid. I mean, the questions are about, you know, resourcing of that. You know, we have a crisis of nursing recruitment in this country. So, you know, some of those are probably a little bit ambitious, but I think that's certainly both of those are overall popular policies. It depends how they feed into the stories that the parties are telling.
Exactly. And the questions are always asked about how you pay for it and where does it come from and how much will the tax on the higher earners be? And all of those bits of information will come out, we hope, in the manifesto. Brace yourself for those manifesto launches. That's the other election campaign favourite, of course. The leaders will all be trotting them out over the next week or so. You're not hearing when they will come, have you?
I believe next Monday for both of them. The Tory one has been put back. So can only imagine
so Monday
there's
week.
Lots of exciting new stuff in it.
Angela and Stephen will be out waving their manifestos around, will they, Monday week?
Well, if we get hold of them. You know, I remember the days we're going to Smith's and buy every single party's manifesto. Now the only way to get them is to download them. I'd like to see the parties putting them out and getting people to actually read them.
Well, look, will people read them in detail? Maybe not. But remember, the party manifestos can and often do have a big impact on the course of government and the culture of politics. John Beazley has been to Tamworth in Staffordshire, former constituency of the reforming Victorian Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel, and the place where the first modern manifesto was addressed to voters in 1834.
To the electors of the Borough of Tamworth, gentlemen, on the 26th of November last, being then in Rome, I received from His Majesty a summons, wholly unforeseen and unexpected by me, to return to England without delay for the purpose of assisting His Majesty in the formation of a new government.
The final act of an epic political crisis played out from the window of a small West Midlands market town hall. King William IV had sacked, for the last time as it turned out, his Prime Minister Lord Melbourne and the entire cabinet. But a successor was proving hard to find.
The King sent for the Duke of Wellington and said, I'd like you to become Prime Minister. And the Duke of Wellington said, no, I'm too old, I'm deaf, and I didn't enjoy it the last time I did it. So Wellington said, send for Peel.
Nigel Morris is chairman of the Peel Society, a group which sustains and promotes the legacy of a statesman who gave us the Metropolitan Police and Catholic Emancipation, as well as being credited with founding the modern Conservative Party and repealing the Corn Laws. But it's his groundbreaking Tamworth Manifesto, named after Sir Robert's constituency, with its pledge not to repeal the 1832 Reform Act and the extension of the franchise, which concerns us here.
On the evening of the 17th of December 1834, a message was sent to the papers to hold the presses, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning, the manifesto arrived and the presses ran, and then it was sent up by stagecoach to Tamworth and read from the room that we're in here, the wonderful old town hall. It was read to the electors by the mayor.
Sir Robert Peel's Tamworth Manifesto was the first time that a Prime Minister had appealed to the people at large to support his approach. And according to the Conservative peer Lord Finkelstein, it set a key precedent.
On the big questions, manifestos have always settled them. So in the Tamworth Manifesto, that was where Peel said, I'm not going to row back on political reform. We are going to be a party that is post the reform age, he said of his Conservative Party. And in the last general election, the manifesto was the place where David Cameron made his commitment to having a European referendum.
Danny Finkelstein himself wrote two Conservative manifestos in government before the 1997 election and from opposition in 2001. He recalls there being a marked difference between the two.
When you are in power, you have much more resource and you can be much more confident that the things that you are saying will really work in government. The peril of trying to do that when you're in opposition is that you have a very small team. I used to joke that the team working on the Conservative Party's manifesto is smaller than the team available to the minister in charge of carpet regulation in central government. You really have a small team, so it's hard to make sure your manifesto is accurate and workable.
As an advisor to Nick Clegg, Polly McKenzie helped draft three Lib Dem manifestos, including the one in 2010, which pledged to abolish tuition fees that in coalition the party eventually agreed to treble.
You absolutely worry that things are going to be a hostage to fortune if you expect to be in government in some way. And that's, you know, one of the ways in which the Lib Dems went wrong in 2010 is having written a manifesto that was very optimistic about everything that was possible. Some of that then wasn't deliverable, and certainly wasn't deliverable when in coalition with a much bigger party.
So how much detail should a manifesto give? Vernon Bogdanore is Professor of Political History at King's College London. He believes brevity has its virtues.
I believe that detailed manifestos are a bit counterproductive, frankly. The value of a manifesto is simply giving the voter a general idea of what a particular party will do if returned to office. And that's something that we in a democracy need to know. We need to know what our party stands for and what it is likely to do. But a whole list of detailed promises, I believe, is rather pointless.
Good morning. Good morning.
8 o'clock at Central Office and straight inside for a final meeting on the manifesto, which was only just arriving from the printers.
Margaret Thatcher's first manifesto in 1979 was a slim volume with just two real pledges, to control the money supply and to create what it called a property-owning democracy through the sale of council houses. At 9,000 words, the text was brief indeed, but the impact, according to the then Labour MP Roy Hattersley, was enormous.
When a manifesto includes something which is startling, new, original, perhaps in a sense extreme, then the manifesto counts. And I think the decision to sell council houses was a defining decision for the Tory party, perhaps a defining decision for politics for 20 years. So that's when the manifesto works. We were bewildered by it. We promised to repeal it, which was a mistake. I personally promised to repeal it, which was a mistake. But it was a rare example of a manifesto having a really important impact on the election.
But 4 years later, it was the Labour manifesto which would prove more memorable.
We can't afford mass unemployment, and this our policy is the one that explains why and how we can travel in the opposite direction.
In 1983, the Labour leader Michael Foote ran on a manifesto which promised to scrap British nuclear weapons, close US military bases in Britain, and withdraw from the European Community, as well as make agreements with the unions covering pay, prices and profits. It was later dubbed by one Labour MP the longest suicide note in history. Lord Hattersley says some in the party, expecting defeat, wanted the left to be blamed.
The idea of the 1983 manifesto was it was incriminated more than a decent manifesto, which is an extraordinary thing to have happened, but that's how it came about. What we decided in about 10 minutes, the manifesto meeting, National Executive on one hand and Shadow Cabinet on the other, was that we'd include every policy document in the book, in the manifesto, which is why it's so many pages long, why it's so long. But it was intended to be a losing manifesto. It must be the only occasion in political history when a party has gone into the election with an intentionally losing manifesto.
The former Lib Dem Director of Policy, Polly McKenzie, is frank about the true purpose of a manifesto. It's intended, she says, to unite the party rather than as a good read for the voters.
It's nice to think of it as a real sales campaign message with a story and beautiful, eloquent prose about your vision of the sunlit uplands. But the problem is there are so many people to get on board with the thing that often it ends up being written by committee, and it'll only be the introduction, or more likely the campaign literature, which is written by an actual copywriter, somebody who knows what elegant prose looks like, instead of, you know, by a policy wonk like me.
But in Tamworth, where the idea of the manifesto was born, I came across one man who had some excellent advice for any party official who's struggling with their umpteenth draft. Do you read manifestos?
Yes, I do. I think it should be simpler than what it is at the moment. I think there could be, shall we say, a précis. I think it's called, is it the right word? Is that the right word?
I think précis is a very good word, yeah.
I would love to sort of see bullet-pointed, where they know exactly where people understand more, rather than gobbledygook, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Well, gobbledygook, I think it is the word he was looking for. Patrick, you're writing the UKIP manifesto, aren't you, with Suzanne Evans? Is that true?
That's an exaggeration. I have input into it, but I will not let daylight in on magic, as they say.
Well, look, we've got some of the old manifestos here in front of us, and some of them are booklets and some are sort of a couple of sheets and some are little tiny pamphlets. What's yours going to be? Have you decided yet?
We'll have quite a substantial manifesto, as we did at the last election, with policies on the complete range of issues and areas, yes.
All right. And Stephen, do you think it's better to be long on sort of ideals and short on detail? Because the mention there of the 1979 manifesto,
I think it very much depends on the national circumstances, doesn't it? And so the last election, I mean, David Cameron was always, you know, very keen to be ambitious. Let's set out a programme for government and let's be held accountable to it. Cabinet meetings, regularly we would go around and kind of give account for in our departments as to whether we are kind of meeting the pledges and promises we made. I think because of we are moving into a period of such uncertainty with Brexit, we don't know what our future trading relationship is going to look like with Europe. Actually, it is right, I think, for this election, for Theresa May and her team to be setting out something that's much broader, much simpler, more based on principles and general frameworks with some specifics in there. So, for example, like the mental health announcement, so long as we can back it up.
What about the net migration target, which is now subject to a lot of discussion? Theresa May herself, of course, says that she would like to get it below 100,000. Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, was asked repeatedly today whether she backed that, and she wouldn't say that. She said, we've got a lot to think through to work out what's the best way to deliver on our priorities. We're having a new manifesto. It's not going to be identical to the last one. Yeah. And then this evening we hear from Conservative Central Office, it will be in the manifesto.
Having a target like that is really important for being clear with the electorate about where our direction is, what we want to achieve, and being ambitious.
So you want a stated target.
My own concern around it, and I've said this previously, is that we've known for quite some time reaching that target with immigration is extremely difficult, if not impossible. But nevertheless, holding that out there, showing the electorate that that is the destination we want to get to, is in line with what they want on the doorsteps. But getting there is going to be very, very tough.
And with your former job hat on, the pensions triple lock, what do you think? I mean, when you were last on this programme, you said it should be examined but kept until 2020. Do you still think that?
Yeah, I still think we should keep it till 2020. That was the promise we made 2 years ago.
What did you say in the manifesto about it?
I think it would be bad faith to even hint at removing the triple lock any time before 2020. But as we've talked about before, there are substantial costs to always committing ourselves to increase the basic state pension above inflation and wages in perpetuity. And I think, you know, some hard questions as part of the tough choices that need to be made in this period, we need to be looking at the kind of overall fairness of the welfare budget and whether we're asking too much in terms of pressure on benefits for working age families.
Angela Smith?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. Manifestos where you promise lots of good things but don't want to say how you pay for them generally, do you? And it's, you know, I think some of this, what Stephen was saying, the immigration target, net immigration figure hasn't been achieved by a government that's promised it already. To keep promising it knowing you can't actually do it seems to me to be somewhat dishonest. And I'm not sure it means that much, because a net migration target means if lots of high-earning, highly qualified professional people leave the UK and unqualified people come in, that might help you reach your target, but that's not what really matters.
Angela,
so I think there are some issues there.
What about the Labour manifesto, though? Is it going to be a repeat of 1983, do you think?
I don't think so. There's a lot of work going on that. We'll see it, you know, as Helen says, for us next Monday. There's been a number of meetings going on. I think all of these manifestos are in a little bit of a rush, because certainly we didn't expect an election so soon. So there have been sort of an extra bit of work has been going on to get the policies there. But I think that the things I would say, I think you don't want a manifesto that goes on and on and on every single, you're not supposed to dot every I and cross every T, but you do need to give, I think, an honest assessment of what is achievable and what your values are trying
and
to get
Simon Fraser, for the civil servants, for the officials working alongside the politicians, how important are the manifestos?
Well, they're very important in one sense, because they give you something so you can brief for the incoming government. You can prepare the policies. If you don't have the manifestos, then when the new ministers arrive, you can't give them the briefing for day one and then subsequent events. But on this election, I'd say there's one big decision that's to be made, and that's what's going to go into the Conservative Party manifesto, because I think the Conservative Party is going to win. But the other thing I'd say is, whatever, the next government is going to be defined by Brexit. And whatever's in the manifesto, the reality is, it seems to me, that Brexit is going to be the defining issue over the lifetime of the next parliament.
Helen, we're getting a couple of policy hints, aren't we, in the papers. What have you got there in the Mail, for instance?
Yeah, inside of the Mail, something that's been strong hints dropped about already now is social care. So what they're hearing is that, you know, sources close to the people writing the manifesto would cap care costs at £85,000. Now, this is an idea that's, you know, depending on where you set the level, has been kicking around for a number of years since the Dilnot Review. You know, it's widely acknowledged that there is a social care crisis. You know, it's a very expensive thing to provide, and actually people are being forced to sell their homes, which they don't like. And we've already had, you know, councils being able to raise 3% extra on council tax to pay for it. So, you know, it's a very expensive policy. It would be £2 billion a year. So the idea is that that might go hand in hand with the end of the triple lock on pensions.
Stephen, do you think that there will finally be the introduction of this cap? I mean, the Lib Dems have talked about it. The Conservatives in coalition have. It's just not happened. It keeps being pushed into the long grass.
And it is a massive issue on the doorsteps. It comes up time and time again. People feel really, really strongly about this. But I'm not going to speculate on what's going to be in our manifesto in a week or
so. Have you heard talk of this idea?
It is something that a lot of ministers are concerned about, because we pick it up from our constituents. And I think, you know, if Theresa and her team are thinking about finally coming up with a plan to deal with this, and I think that would be
the
hugely...
The figure is 85,000.
I don't know. We shouldn't speculate, but... you know, the mood in the country is for an answer and a solution. So it is overdue. I think it'd be good if it was in the manifesto.
All right, a couple of other headlines then, Helen.
Well, just to give you a bit of a flavour of Labour manifesto, the Morning Star's leading on Labour's junk food ban before 9 p.m, so an extension of that. In order to tackle childhood obesity, they also want to create a £250 million fund for that.
Advertising. We couldn't eat it before 9 p.m.
Probably some of us would find that quite helpful.
Adverts for junk food, sweets and sugary drinks banned on primetime television shows. And just time for one more headline then, Helen.
And then everyone else really has gone, as you might expect, for Macron. You know, with some of the caveats that we talked about earlier in the programme, you know, he hasn't got any legislative representation at the moment. You know, there was a big vote still for his opponent. But nonetheless, you know, a feeling of celebration from, you know, liberal globalisers across Europe, really.
Okay. Okay. Well, yes, you will be able to eat junk food before 9 o'clock. You just won't be able to see it on an advert under the Labour Party if they win the general election. That is all we have time for this evening. Thanks to all my guests, Helen Lewis, Sir Simon Fraser, Stephen Crabb, Angela Smith and Patrick O'Flynn. Join us again same time next Sunday. Until then, from all of us here at the Westminster Hour, thanks for listening.